Hello and welcome to episode 187 of Page One, the Writer's Podcast. I'm Tarek.
I'm Marco, and thanks for joining us for another episode of the podcast that speaks to writers to find out how they got into the industry, try and get as many hints and tips from them as possible, and something else that I always say that I can't remember.
Professionals.
Yes, professionals here.
What is it?
What happened was that I slightly changed the wording of what I said
and that threw me off entirely.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway,
tried to vary it up.
It's a podcast about writers for writers. I think that's maybe a neater way of putting it. And we have a huge back catalogue of guests there, so please do go and check those out if you haven't already. Now, if you listen to the end of the last episode, I did say that we were going to get into a series of industry episodes where we're speaking to agents, editors, things like that, that were going to be video interviews with some of the people in the industry to give you a bit more info about what happens once, you know, you've written that book and it's out there and how it gets published. But you will know if you've downloaded this episode and looked at the podcast cover that we don't have that. We've got one extra special author this week.
We do indeed. We have the fantastic Kim Sherwood with us this week, who has written Testament. That was her debut novel. Mm-hmm. 2018 went on to win the Bath Novel Award, a long list of the Desmond Elliott Prize.
But the Bath Novel Award is how she was picked up, in fact.
That's what she was picked. Exactly, yeah. So Bath Novel Award is an award which is for unpublished, unedited writers. It's quite a big award to win. Announces you quite well. So she, I think it was one of the judges, she says, ends up being her agent. So that was how she got into the industry. Spoiler. And but perhaps what she's best known for, certainly how I know her anyway, is from her new trilogy of officially sanctioned by the Ian Fleming Estate James Bond books. So Double or Nothing came out in 2022. That was the first one, and she'll chat about it. It's kind of a modern take on Bond.
Bond is in the books mentioned and everything,
yes,
but it focuses on the other 00s, which is always interesting. You know, it sort of expands that world.
Yeah, that's right. I remember as a kid watching GoldenEye, and I loved the fact you had 006 in there because it was like, oh, there's. It kind of gave you that bit more of the world building around it. And obviously he was an arsehole. So I think these agents are much nicer. And our latest book is A Spy Like Me, which is the second James Bond book.
Out this week.
This week, today at time of recording. So yesterday, if you are listening to this on day of release.
you could keep going.
So confusing.
2 days ago, if you're
so
listening.
2 days ago, if you're on Saturday. But yeah, no, it's a great chat. She's super interesting. And she also teaches on the creative writing master's course at Edinburgh University.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting chat. Just hearing about, you know, how she broke in and also, you know, working with a property like James Bond and what all that involves and how she even got that gig in the first place, which is also interesting as well. So, we'll get straight into it after a quick advert for our writer's notebook. Then we'll be back at the end of the podcast with a bit more chat and to let you know a bit more detail about these industry episodes that are coming up next week.
But for now, on with the podcast.
The Blank Page. To some, it's terrifying, an obstacle to overcome. But we prefer to think of it as an opportunity, a blank canvas to be filled with all of the adventures and characters in our head. So how to overcome that fear? Well, we all know the best advice for a writer is write. Seriously, get words on the page and more will follow.
But what about later, when you start trying to pull those threads of what you've written together? What about the character you wrote about way back at the start? Who was she again? What was she carrying? And where did she leave the MacGuffin that she now really needs in the third act? Think about all those top thrillers you like to read. Or that amazing drama you just watched. What did they all have in common? Structure and planning.
As aspiring writers ourselves, we've tried many different methods to try and organise all the thoughts about the stories we want to tell. We've been there, searching for a piece of scrap paper to note something down, or making a quick note on our phone in between meetings.
Or sometimes we'll make a note in whatever notebook we're carrying or a document on our laptop so we don't forget that great idea. Let's be honest, it can all be a bit messy and it's easy to lose track of everything. And that's when we realise it's not just a story that needs structure and planning, but the way we gather all of our thoughts about it as well.
And so we made Page One. Page One is more than just another notebook. It's a place to put down all your ideas for your latest project, divided into easy-to-use sections that will help you plan your story, so that when that blank page comes calling, you're ready to answer. And then afterwards, once it's written, we realised you need to plan how to let people read it, so we included a section relating to submissions.
Each one is designed for one project, whether you want to write a book, screenplay, a comic, or any other kind of story. We truly believe that when you use it, it will help you get to the main event, writing your story. So we hope this helps.
We can't wait to read what you come up with.
And remember, every story starts with Page One.
I was reading that you grew up writing short stories, you made illustrated books and things like this. I mean, was being a writer something that you wanted to do from a very early age then?
Absolutely, yeah. I feel really lucky that when I was about four, I'm told, I said I want to be a writer, and nobody laughed at me and told me that was ridiculous. I've always thought that was really fortunate, because I was just encouraged, and creativity was really encouraged in our house, and going to the local library, going to the local secondhand bookshop. And so those spaces became really welcoming for me, and spaces where I felt really at home. And the dream was always to become a writer. And like I say, I just feel very grateful that my mum never said, oh, well, that's, you know, that could be a hobby, or maybe you need another plan. Or she just said, you know, if you work really hard and it's your passion, and, you know, just go for it. And all those kind of early years of making and illustrating books, and that creative process has really stayed with me. So I still, I'm not especially well, but I still sketch my characters and draw out maps of my settings and, you know, paint the interior rooms that my characters inhabit. And that's always been a really important part of my creative process.
I read as well that you were sort of drawn to the particular types of books that you seemed to be interested in when you were younger, were the sort of adventure books like Famous Five, but also stuff like Robert Louis Stevenson, Arthur Conan Doyle, and James Bond, which we'll get back to later on. But I mean, were these the types of stories that you really enjoyed exploring?
Absolutely. Famous Five meant so much to me. Famous Five was always what I spent my pocket money on. I used to look after, you know, neighbours' fish, very low stakes, and water their gardens. So then they'd pay me, you know, 20p, and I'd save it up and I'd go and buy Famous Five. And I loved Famous Five so much because, of course, there was George. There was this girl with short hair. I have short hair. I always have. Who loved adventures. And she had an island. So, you know, that's something to aspire to. but she was quite unusual in adventure stories at that time. These days, you'll find books that specifically say, you know, adventures for girls on the covers and that kind of thing. Great. And of course, you can identify with male characters as a girl. I identified with a lot of them. But it's really nice to have a character who you can see yourself in. Mm-hmm. And George was that for me. And then, of course, you know, things like Treasure Island, which really influenced my latest novel that isn't a Bond novel, A Wild and True Relation, which is a smuggling novel. I loved Robert Louis Stevenson. I loved Conan Doyle. And then discovering Ian Fleming I first bought a Fleming novel when I was 12. And that was really life-changing for me in ways that I couldn't really have anticipated. But he became one of my favorite writers. And I just read and reread all of his novels as a teenager. And I loved his style. And I loved that sense of going on a quest. You know, I as a little kid, I would play these adventure games and spy games in our back garden. I grew up in North London and all of the gardens kind of run together. Mm-hmm. And I would be climbing into people's gardens and I'd be spying on my neighbours, who luckily were very tolerant of this. And I would write little novels about, you know, mysteries that were going on in the neighbourhood. And I think that love of adventure and love of mystery and love of spy fiction as a kid really trained me to be a writer, because it taught me to be observational and to pay attention to people's characters and to I used to play this game actually with my mum when we'd go on walks on Hampstead Heath, where I would come up with descriptions for things. And I'd come up with similes and metaphors. And again, luckily, my mum didn't say, stop being precocious. She just encouraged me. So that was really formative, loving those books and wanting that sense of adventure.
I mean, it's funny because you obviously love these kind of adventure spy books and stuff. And I'm assuming because that was the stuff you were reading, is that the kind of stuff you were writing growing up, those kind of stories? Because your first published novel seems very different from all of that stuff.
Yeah, so I in a way I had, I suppose, a quite varied taste in what I was reading growing up and what I read now. So I love everything from Hilary Mantel to Lee Child. And again, I feel fortunate that nobody told me you have to have one genre that you love to either read in or write in. And I would go down to our local secondhand bookshop in Camden and I would just load up my arms with everything from literary theory to Ian Fleming. And that, I think, gave me a real respect and appreciation for all of the different ways that we can tell stories. As you say, my first novel is very different from James Bond, although I snuck a few Bond references in there. But my first novel is kind of literary fiction about the ways in which grief and trauma are inherited through three generations of a family since the Holocaust. And I think the... That spectrum of reading did really kind of fuel me as a writer with cross-fertilization, because of course everything, and you know, you guys will know this as well, everything we come across can feed into what we're writing in so many different unexpected ways. So although Testament, my first novel, is not a thriller, the way that Ian Fleming writes about place, the way he has that really fantastic journalistic eye for travel, I think that really affected me growing up. And so when I came to write Testament, which is set across Europe, approaching writing about Budapest, about Berlin, about Prague, I think Ian Fleming's journalistic eye really influenced how I tried to shape my own style.
Mm-hmm. And how did it get there? How did it become the published book? I mean, you were obviously writing from the age of four or whatever, but at what stage did you seriously start to try and, you know, pursue that as a possibility?
Well, I studied creative writing at undergraduate, so I studied literature with creative writing as a degree at UEA, and you'll have lots of listeners who are writers, and I would say you don't need to go and study it to become a writer. That's one way, but it's not the only way, but that was what I did. And then I went on to do the MA in creative writing at UEA. I was very one-track minded, I think. You know, I kind of knew what my passion was and I wanted to be surrounded by that. And my first novel came about sort of in a way as a surprise, because I thought that my first novel was going to be A Wild and True Relation, my recent kind of, it's a literary historical feminist smuggling adventure that just came out last year, and I thought that would be my first novel. I was working on that during my undergrad and took it on to the MA with me. But then my grandfather, the actor George Baker, passed away, and he was really a father figure in my life, and losing him really in some ways turned my world upside down. And I think often we turn to writing as a way to process those paradigm shifts when everything we know suddenly doesn't seem true anymore. So I started to write Testament, and it was really born from grief, and it's about the relationship between a granddaughter and a grandfather. And it's not my grandfather's life story, but the seed of it came from my relationship with him and losing him. And I wrote that novel for 7 years before I had an agent, you know, not knowing if it would be published or not. But I think, you know, for debut writers, I would always say, I think that we write to answer some inner question that we have, and we might not always know what that question is. Sometimes it can take years to articulate, but there's some kind of inner compulsion that drives us to spend years coming up with these imaginary people and thinking about them, you know, more often than we think about real people in our lives. So there's some real driver behind that. And for me, with Testament, I just had to write it. I had to use the novel as a container for my grief and a container for what I was learning about the Holocaust and my family's losses and survival through the Holocaust in Hungary. So I was working on the book for 7 years, didn't know where it'd be picked up or if it would be. Finally got to the end, sent it out to agents, and then there's the agonizing wait where you're refreshing your email every 5 minutes. And over about 9 months, maybe, I just got rejections or encouraging no's, but nobody wanted it. And then my partner was really encouraging me to enter the Bath Novel Award, which is an international award for unpublished manuscripts. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing it, and I was kind of hesitating. And then on the night of the deadline, like 5 minutes to midnight, Nick said to me, "Well, why aren't you submitting the book?" And I said, "Well, I don't think it would get anywhere." And he said, "Well, if that's the only reason, I really think you should go for it." So he kind of walked me over to my computer and we got the submission form up and pressed send. I'm told I'm their latest ever submission. And I won. So I really owe it all to Nick. And the judge became my agent, Sue Armstrong at Cumberland Walsh. So That was extraordinary. And I always say that to my students, that you don't know which door will open for you, and you might get lots of rejections. You probably will, but it's just about knocking on doors, and one day the right door will open, and you only need one door to open.
I mean, obviously we've recorded a lot of these episodes, but it is remarkable how, you know, so much of the being successful in this world is, yes, you have to write well and you have to write something good, but a lot of it is just serendipity, it's timing, it's getting it in front of the right person at the right time. And it makes a massive difference. And obviously that is completely out of the hands of the author. Yeah. So I guess all they can do is, you know, write the best thing that they can write. And as hard as it is, not let these rejections, if they come in, knock them back and put them off, because, you know, that I don't know if it was, but that probably played some part in your hesitancy reticence to enter that competition.
Absolutely. And there's I live up in Edinburgh now, and there's that great Scottish saying, "What's for you won't go by you." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I really love that. I think that's true in life, and it's true in writing. It can be so hard not to take those rejections personally, of course, because being creative in public is inherently vulnerable. The creativity has come from somewhere deep inside you. As I say, there's this kind of inner compulsion, inner question, which is deeply personal. And then when you send it out into the world, you have to have a little bit of distance so that you can say to yourself, well, just because it's not right for that person, that doesn't diminish the work, and it doesn't mean it won't be right for somebody else. So I think it's, as you say, you have to write the best book that you can, write for yourself, and then keep knocking on those doors and wait for the yes. And then once you have that yes, so then I sold the book to River Run, an imprint of Quercus. And my editor, when I met my editor, I felt like we had been friends all of my life within about 5 minutes. You know, it was just that immediate connection. And I felt so grateful that my agent had thought of her. And she was the big yes, because, again, you know, the novel went out on submission. Lots of publishers passed. You know, it's a sort of tricky sell. Debut novel about the Holocaust, you know, commercially, people would kind of raise their eyebrows at that. But Rose, my editor at River Run, she went for it. And it's funny, she had imagined, because she loved the book so much, that there was intense competition for it. So she would, you know, she was really fiercely going for it with my agent. And years later, I said to her, "But you know, you're the only one." And she was like, "Oh my God, I'm going to give you a way small advance." But, you know, she had the passion.
But it's also interesting, because it sounds like writing Testament was a kind of therapy, I suppose, in a way, you know, to get through your grief and to explore this kind of complex family relationships that you had. And obviously, you know, you talk about having to write the right book to the right person at the right time, but it's also probably writing the right book at the right time, because you put your book you were writing to one side to work on this. You had this kind of compulsion to say, "No, I need to stop working on what became a wild and true relation, and I need to write this book now. And I suppose that's someone you have to listen to if you have this urge to tell a story. It probably means it's the right time to write it because it's fresh and it's raw.
I think that's right. I think the right project comes along at the right time, and it could be tricky. Sometimes I'll have students saying to me, well, I'm procrastinating from my dissertation, say, and I've started another novel. And I always have to check in with them. Is that because you're scared of your dissertation and so you're distracting yourself? Or is it because actually your dissertation is the wrong book and there's something else calling you? And I think with Testament, it was an act of catharsis and containment to externalize what I was processing onto the page and have it safely contained on the page. I had to write that book. I think also I needed some distance from A Wild and True Relation because I had started writing that book as a student and I took it onto the MA with me, and institutionalized creativity in some ways is a strange notion. And I say that a little bit hypocritically because I'm a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Edinburgh. But that book, I was, you know, workshopping it weekly with different groups and different lecturers. And I was really young. I was 22 when I did my MA. And everybody had a different opinion. Everybody thought the book should be a different thing. And because they were all older and wiser than me, I believed them all. So then I started to try and write 24 books in one. And it kind of broke under the weight of that. So when I moved to writing Testament, I wasn't even sure I would return to writing A Wild and True Relation. And A Wild and True Relation from start to finish was 14 years of my life, obviously not working on it every day. Other books happened in between, but there were times where I stepped away from it and I didn't think it would resurrect. And I think in those moments, sometimes we do have to have some distance, and we might, you know, say to people around us, nope, that book's done. I'm never going to write it again. And I think it's really important to have people who will be your champions and will say, well, we loved it and we hope that one day you return to it. And people who kind of give you that encouragement.
Yeah.
You know, similarly to Nick encouraging me to enter the Bath Novel Award, I think it's really important to have those cheerleaders and champions around you, whether it's friends, whether it's family, whether it's mentors, because writing relies on the creative spirit, I suppose you could call it, working. And sometimes there'll be moments where we just don't have that faith and that self-belief, or we just don't have the energy. And if you've got people around you saying, oh, but we really loved those characters, we want to find out what happens next, that could just mean the world in encouraging you to go back to a project later.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, because writing is so solitary as a thing. You know, it's you in your head, and you know, you're writing it out there, and sometimes it goes easy, sometimes it flows, but getting the smallest bit of encouraging feedback or whatever goes a long way in helping you keep going, I think, at times. So, I totally agree with all of that. Now, your second published book was, of course, the first in this new Bond trilogy. And obviously, you've talked about your love for Ian Fleming and stuff. How did it come around? You know, because it's not the most logical move from writing Testament, winning the Bath Novel Prize, to then suddenly writing this. So how did that happen?
Well, it was an extraordinary turn of events that was completely unexpected. One day my agent called me and said the Ian Fleming estate is interested in talking to you about writing James Bond. And I genuinely thought it was a hoax. I thought that she was just playing a really cruel joke on me. But she had remembered that the very first time I ever met with her, after I'd won the Bath Novel Award, my agency took me out for lunch. And she said to me, what are your writing dreams? And I said, one day I want to write James Bond. And she didn't laugh at me. So she took it quite seriously. She said, oh, yeah, you should do that. So I thought, well, I'll sign with this agent for sure. And she had remembered that. And years later, she heard that the Fleming estate were looking for a new writer because Anthony Horowitz's tenure had come to an end. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to go in a new direction with the project. And they'd been looking particularly for kind of younger writers and female writers who were massive Bond fans. And they'd kind of been coming up empty. Mm-hmm. And so Sue got in touch with them and said, well, I might have the writer for you. And they had liked my first book and they'd noticed the Bond references I'd put in there, flying my flag. And they invited me to send them some ideas. So I wrote them a letter, you know, with every single idea I've had since I was 12 for a James Bond novel. And my agent said to me, is there any evidence we can send along as well to kind of prove that you're a Bond fan? Because it's really important to the family. You know, this is their family legacy. Mm. They want somebody who's really passionate. And luckily, my mum had kept this bit of homework I'd done at school when I was 14. And our English teacher had asked us to write about an author that we admire. And I'd made this booklet on Ian Fleming, and it had illustrations and flaps and all these things. So we photocopied that, obviously kept the original, photocopied that and sent it off to the Flemings and just said, you know, this would literally be a lifelong dream come true.
I mean, how could they say no after that, surely?
Yeah, well, exactly. It would just be rude at that point.
Harsh, like, yeah.
They liked my ideas. They liked my homework. And they invited me in to chat with them, and it all kind of unfolded from there. So it's completely unexpected and a real lesson in saying very far-fetched dreams out loud, because one day they might just manifest.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how does the, you know, you said you had to picture the Fleming estate, and it's their family. Is that right? Is it still his family
that's right, yeah.
Estate? So how does that work in terms of, you know, you're working in someone's sandbox and it's their baby, and they've still got the final sign off, I take it, and control. So how does it work in terms of what you're allowed to do or not do, and what you have to ask permission for and stuff like that?
So they're really encouraging. Once they've chosen an author, they say, we've chosen you, we want your vision. The only criteria they gave me was to set it in the modern day. They wanted it to feel really contemporary, and to expand the world of James Bond, introducing new 00 agents. But how I went about that was up to me. So I was given a huge amount of freedom. And the way that I wanted to approach it was to take this kind of, it's an opportunity and a challenge to bring in these new 00 agents, because of course, James Bond is such a star. So the way that I envisioned it was, if he is a star, then he has his own gravity. And if he's on the page or the screen, all eyes go to him. All energy is drawn to him. So if you want to introduce 004 and 003 and 009 as main characters, James Bond needs to step into the shadows a little bit and allow the spotlight to move on to those new characters. So I decided that he had gone missing on a mission, and MI6 didn't know whether he'd been captured, whether he'd been killed. And these new 00 agents were trying to find him while also in Double or Nothing, trying to avert a climate disaster. And I kind of mapped it like a universe. I thought about how all these stars are related to each other. So we have 003, Johanna Harwood, the first main character to be a female 00, who's had a romantic relationship with Bond in the past that hasn't ended especially well, I don't think it would be a shock to anyone to hear. She's now in a relationship with 009, Sid Bashir, who was mentored by Bond. So there's a slightly uncomfortable love triangle going on in the workplace. And then there's 004, Joseph Dryden, who's former Special Forces and just knows Bond as a kind of surly, good-looking man around the office. He's gone missing, and that mainly just represents a security risk to him. So the agents have kind of different relationships to Bond, and he's more or less present depending on which strand you're in. And I decided to make it multi-stranded, make it an ensemble cast, because I thought it's an opportunity to create a little bit of a different structure. The James Bond novels are traditional quest narratives. You have your single hero who gets his mission from M, and he goes out into the world and he picks up a couple of allies and he slays the dragon and he gets the prize at the end. Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to do something a little bit different, I thought, let's make it an ensemble cast. Let's make it multi-strand, multi-protagonist. And that also takes a little bit of the pressure off these new characters. Because if you say to people, right, in the first book, James Bond is missing and I'd like you to meet 006, and he's a tall white man with dark hair and grey blue eyes, he's very charming, you know, what would be the point? So I thought, this is an opportunity to, you know how I said earlier on, I used to play James Bond in my garden as a little kid. You know, I'd always play as James Bond, I didn't play as a Bond girl. And that's no insult to Bond girls, but nobody wants to be rescued. You want to, you want to be the hero of your own story. And this seemed to me to be an opportunity to bring in some more diversity and inclusivity into the Bond franchise and allow more people to see themselves as the hero of their own story. So we can bring in 00s with different backgrounds, different perspectives, and also reflect the reality of modern intelligence services, where diversity, I read on the MI6 literature, they said diversity is a strategic asset. And I thought that was a particularly cold way of putting it, but it's really fascinating that they have kind of seen it as in response to particularly 9/11. They did this kind of audit. This was the CIA. They did an audit and they realized that one of the reasons they'd missed a lot of the indications leading up to 9/11 was that everybody was very kind of WASPy. And, there was a lot of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants with the same perspective, so they'd all missed the same clues, and none of them had thought to question each other. And they call it perspective blindness. And they said, in response to this, we have to develop diversity as a strategic asset. So I thought that was really fascinating, and it kind of shows how a lot of the media that we see about the spy world, which can be very kind of white and heteronormative, really actually isn't the reality at all.
And how was it writing a book, compared to writing your own stories, your completely own stories, like A Wild and True Relation or Testament? Obviously, there's a lot exists already, and there's a so in that sense, and there's a lot of familiarity that people will bring to that, to a Bond novel. So is that easier, or is that harder, or is it a bit of both?
It's a bit of both, I think. The real favor it gives you is the symbolism that we carry in our cultural unconscious for James Bond. Even if you're not a big Bond fan, you kind of know the car, the suits, throwing the hat in Moneypenny's office. You kind of have it in your mind. And that, as a writer, gives you this really rich symbolism that you can call on very deftly at a moment's notice in any scene. And it almost, there was actually a nice review. I don't usually read reviews because I think that way madness lies, but there was a nice review of Double or Nothing in the Washington Post. So I did read that one. And they described James Bond as a series of gestures that I had given to other characters in the novel, in that 003 drives a very beautiful fast car, the Alpine, 004, Joseph Dryden is very well dressed, those kinds of things. I thought that was a really really interesting idea, James Bond as a series of gestures, because it does have that kind of quick reference that we can all go through. And so that really lends itself to almost a kind of treasure box that you can rummage through, and you can say, right, what image do I want in this moment? I think also because I started to read Fleming when I was so young and he really influenced my style, I just tried to become more self-aware around how he'd influenced my style. And I thought about these connecting DNA points between his writing and mine. And I think my writing is very imagery rich, and I think that came from him. His similes are just brilliant. I would say he's actually a very underrated stylist, as strange as it may sound to say Ian Fleming's underrated. And then also he uses third person omniscient point of view, which is kind of an old-fashioned point of view these days, but he uses it brilliantly. And that was a great gift to me because I've got this ensemble cast, so I've got multiple perspectives that I'm occupying. So I tried to think about how I could draw on this rich heritage. I reread all of the novels. I thought about plot strands that he'd left untied that I could pick back up again. So you'll meet some familiar favourites in Double or Nothing and A Spy Like Me, and also some characters who are less well known because they never made it to screen. But they're actually some of my favourite characters, particularly female characters who just never carried over into the films. So I tried to create this web between my books and his, and I have kind of headcanon. This was the challenging part because I wanted it to feel very connected to his world, but his world. He sat down to write Casino Royale in 1952. So his world is very different from mine. So I have a kind of headcanon version of all of his novels as if he wrote them in the 90s and 2000s, and as if my novels are picking up immediately from them. Maybe one day I'll write a, I don't know, a modern version of Moonraker with neo-Nazis instead of Nazis. It's fortunately very easy to modernize those.
Well, I mean, your new book, as you mentioned just there, is A Spy Like Me, and that's the second book in your Bond trilogy. So, Jordan, that's right. out in 2 days' time at the time of recording, yeah. the 25th of April. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
So in A Spy Like Me, MI6 discovers a smuggling ring that is funding terror through stealing and looting and smuggling diamonds and art, antiquities, people. And every 6 days, a bomb is going to go off somewhere in the world, funded by this smuggling network. And in the opening of the book, and this isn't a spoiler because it happens pretty much on page one, the opening of the book, a bomb goes off in the BBC, and MI6 realize they only have 6 days to stop the next bomb anywhere in the world. So our different agents go down these different smuggling pipelines. And this was really inspired by Goldfinger and Diamonds Are Forever and Ian Fleming's love for smuggling as well as my own. So we have 004 Joseph Dryden, who's former Special Forces, going to Afghanistan to track down the looting and smuggling of antiquities. We have a new character, Rachel Wolfe, who's a diamond thief, who gets the kind of tap on the shoulder from Moneypenny. Moneypenny's been promoted, a long overdue promotion to head of the 00 section. So Rachel Wolfe is tracking down diamonds going through the pipeline from Europe to Dubai. And then we have 003 Johanna Harwood, who is on the trail of a people smuggler who she believes is responsible for the disappearance of James Bond. So we follow our agents down these different pipelines, and they all, I guess we could say, collide by the end of the novel.
Excellent.
Nice. And obviously the first one had a good reception, but I did want to ask, because unfortunately it is a theme in modern internet times, that obviously a female writer of James Bond, did you experience pushback on that from people?
Yeah, that it's been this whole thing has been such a learning curve to go from writing literary fiction that was, received well and won awards and sold well and everything, but it's a totally different world than writing something like James Bond. So I was really unprepared. I don't know if you actually could prepare, because it's just such a different experience. And I had a great favor actually with writing Double or Nothing. I was writing it during the pandemic and I wasn't allowed to tell anybody I was writing it. So it was a complete secret and I could just be in my dream world. And then when they announced that I was writing it, it went up as a news story on The Guardian. And for some reason, I didn't really even think people would notice. So it went up on The Guardian, tweeted about it. I went to make a cup of tea and I came back to my computer. And I mean, like everything was just blowing up and I had thousands of notifications and BBC was calling me, and I went down to the corner shop on the weekend and my face was in all the papers. Like it was completely kind of mind-boggling. And at first the reception from what I would call the real Bond fan community was really positive, which was so fantastic to see. And people were excited by the idea. I think there's always been a lot of curiosity around, well, who are the other 00s? So there was curiosity around that. And people were excited to see a woman doing it, because the James Bond community is I would say, one of the most kind of inclusive and diverse fandoms out there. And I think people were excited to see a different, not different direction necessarily, but a new vision being brought in. But then it went up on the Daily Mail and Sky News. And then I had just a kind of wave of misogyny and people saying I would all of the different trolls from under all of the different bridges. So people afraid that I was going to make it too feminist, that I was going to make it too diverse, that I was going to bring in different sexualities. And I say afraid deliberately. I think a lot of this comes from a position of fear and people feeling like something they love is going to be taken away from them or not belong to them anymore. And so I can have some empathy for that, but it was really coming with a lot of, I guess, presumption that because I am a young woman, I was going to not be a Bond fan, and that this was going to be a kind of inauthentic
Yeah, you've come in to make it super woke and
exactly, yeah, and really kind of weaponizing that word.
Yeah.
And I sadly I wasn't that surprised. I think anytime a woman sticks her head over the parapet in a male dominated field, this will happen.
Yeah.
And at first I thought, well, I just won't go on social media. I just won't look at any of it. But then I thought, well, that's not really fair, because there is this what I would call the True Bond community who've been really welcoming and positive, and it would be really fun to get to know these folks and get to play with them in this sandbox because I'm one of them. So then I thought, well, I'm just going to try and cut out all of that negative noise and those presumptions that people have acting from, as I say, I think a place of fear and anger, maybe isolation, and just focus really on the positives. And I thought, I've got this amazing opportunity, this amazing platform has been given to me, and I could use that energy to encourage the kind of voices that I think ought to be center stage and encourage the kind of creativity in the fandom. And so I've ended up collaborating a lot with folks like Licensed to Queer, looking at Bond from a queer angle, doing a lot of kind of grassroots community events, a lot of podcasts that don't have big audiences, but they have really dedicated audiences, and it's people doing amazing creative stuff. And that's what I want to encourage. And the rest is, it's kind of just noise, and it's nothing really to do with me. So mm-hmm. I think, as you know, if anybody's about to enter a world like this and is worried about it, I think my advice would be just to know it's nothing to do with you. So all you can do is put your energy into things that you really want to encourage, and don't reply, don't worry about it, don't read comments, just mm-hmm. don't waste any energy on that.
I'm always fascinated by these arguments, because whenever you get things, and you see it a lot in like remakes, like when something gets announced that they're remaking something, the fans of the original go mental, because they're like, you know, how they're remaking Back to the Future, it's good, you know, this is awful, this is
no, as if someone's be wrong, Tarek.
No, well, but it's as if they're going to come, someone's going to come around to your house and pick up your DVDs and snap them in half and say, well, you can't have this anymore. Now you
it doesn't exist anymore.
This new one, you know, which is, and because it's new and it's remake, it's completely opposite, and we've gender swapped the rules, and it's a bloody comedy now. And it's, you know, no one's taking it away from you. I always find it quite difficult to understand where the anger, you know, if you don't like it, just don't watch it, don't read it. It's,
exactly. Yeah, there's nothing to say. You have to join in if you don't want to.
Exactly.
Join.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think my attitude is always the more the merrier. But I certainly wouldn't want to kind of bring people along who don't want to come along. That's fine.
Yeah. Exactly.
But as you say, you know, for me, being such a fan of Ian Fleming and all of the films, I find it really exciting whenever there's something that brings new energy into that world. So, you know, when Sebastian Foulkes came in and did his Bond novel, I was so excited that they were bringing in, a writer like him, and that it was getting this new energy. When a new comic book comes out, how cool to get to see it in a different way. So my feeling is just always the more the merrier. And I think it contributes to this amazing legacy. When you think about it, you know, James Bond is a literary creation, 70 years old in the cinema, 71 now in the cinema. They had the 60 year celebration last year. It's really rare to have something that adapts and evolves with its times like that under the one umbrella. So you could say, well, look at Sherlock Holmes, for example, but of course the Conan Doyle estate hasn't got control of that. So that's this
refused
thing. Which is great in its own way. But the fact that you've got the one family, the Broccoli family, involved in the films all this time, and you've got the one family, the Flemings, involved in the books all this time, and the character has not only survived but thrived while evolving, I just think that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, just thinking about it, just the very fact that it's James Bond, especially, you know, with even the films, the actors have all changed. They've all brought something very different to the role and things like that.
Absolutely.
You know, it as a character, as a world, it has, as you say, always been something that is open to change and is there will be a new interpretation all the time. Yeah. And I think it's all the better for it.
And that's why it survived, I think. You know, you have to be able to adapt to survive. And when you look at the films, they do really massively change tonally.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Honorita Moore, in how they approach things like sex. When you go back to Dalton's films, you know, that was at the height of the AIDS crisis. So they really wanted to play down him kind of being this, I guess you could say, promiscuous figure. They wanted to dial that down. So there's always these different things. You know, when Casino Royale came out, I remember almost jumping in my seat when Judi Dench said, since 9/11, suddenly it was in our world.
Yeah.
But it can evolve like that. And I think that's...
And that was going from Die Another Day, which was just, you know, the other end of scale in terms of invisible cars and kind of that kind of fantasy. gadget-heavy stuff. Fantasy. Yeah, exactly.
Fantasy. And I think that's why James Bond remains the hero that he is and remains a talisman for our times, because he can change.
And I wanted to ask you about tie-in books, because we've chatted to a lot of authors before on the podcast who have done tie-in books, but I think it's been like more sci-fi stuff like Alien and these kind of books, and a lot of the sci-fi tie-in books, I get the impression that it's quite a hard grind, like it's short turnaround times, not very much money, and you know, they pump up maybe 4 or 5 a year, whereas with Bond it seems a very different model, because it's quite limited, that there's not a lot of Bond books, you know, they're not saturating the market with them. I get the impression it's not the same kind of, you've got 6 months to write this book from the first meeting, go. And does it feel like a tie-in in the same way that you view tie-ins for other franchises? Or does it feel like a kind of, you know, different thing?
It does feel like a different thing. It's interesting for me, coming to it from the experience of literary fiction, that being my background. And folks listening might be thinking, well, what do you mean by literary fiction? In some ways, it's kind of a nebulous genre, but commercially, it's very different. And the expectations and the timescale and the money is very different. So as I said, with Testament, I took 7 years writing that book, A Wild and True Relation, at 14 years from start to finish. Then when I signed on to do this, the agent for the Fleming estate said to me, you can write a book a year, right, Kim? And of course, in those moments, you just say, yeah, absolutely.
I could do it.
Never tried to write a book in a year before, but I was very confident that I could. And then in retrospect, I thought, what a mad thing to agree to. But there are some writers, you know, writers working, as you say, in, say, the start, you know, some great Star Trek books, but they produce those novels so quickly. It's amazing. For me, I've had to learn a totally new way to write, because my tendency is to take a long time and to massively overwrite. So to kind of gather material, almost like sculpting, gather and gather and gather, and then cut it down into the shape that you want it to be. But if you're trying to write a book in a year, you can't, you can't have an excess 40,000 words that you whittle away. There just simply isn't time for that. So I've tried to learn to write in a more targeted way. And at first I tried to be quite strict with myself in planning. But then I realized that, you know, for some writers that really works, have a really detailed plan and to kind of follow it chapter by chapter. But for me, it helps to have ideas and a plan to begin with. And I do love drawing big diagrams and big maps, but very quickly I kind of throw those out the window, because I think the more that you write a book, the more you get to know it, like getting to know a person, the more it will tell you what it wants to be. So I've always felt like you can't even know the beginning of a book until you finished it. And so much will happen in the editing process. That's still writing. But I've had to learn to do that on fast forward, because there's no time to kind of go down a 40,000 word cul-de-sac and realize that it went nowhere. So for me, the pressure of bringing the books out has been something I've never experienced before, and something that has been a challenge. But I keep thinking about, who was it that said pressure is a privilege? Maybe Billie Jean King. I keep thinking about that. You know, it's times where it feels hard, I think, well, you are writing James Bond, so.
is there more planning involved, do you think? You have to actually, as you say, we don't have time to waste finding out by writing. You have to know where you're going. And then
exactly. And it was a different process to begin with, because I mapped out the three books and gave the plan to the Flemings to sign off on at the very beginning, and then the publishers to sign off on. But I have completely then changed aspects as I've gone, especially because right now we're living through such a tumultuous period geopolitically and socially, and I want the books to feel rooted in our world. That was a challenge to begin with, because I started to write these books in March 2020, not an auspicious time to write a globe-hopping adventure.
Yes.
And I didn't know what to do with the pandemic. Do you include it? How can you have a James Bond adventure where no one can go anywhere and they're wearing masks? So I thought, well, the book's not coming out until September 2022. It'll all be over by then, I thought. So I set it a little bit down the line. But when you read it, it's kind of very contemporary feeling. It's set around Christmas 2021, but there's just no mention of the pandemic, because I thought it would all be over by then. I imagined it would take, for some reason, I decided it was going to follow term times and that by the new semester, it would be over. But book one has that strange quirk. Book two is much more kind of rooted in reality. And because of that, it's changed shape a little bit. So, for example, one of the main characters, Joseph Dryden, he is former special forces. And this was some research I did around kind of the reality of intelligence agencies. And I discovered that a lot of former special forces soldiers who are injured are then kind of medically downgraded from the front line, but they're recruited as spies because they have all of this experience and so much training and money has been poured into them. So they kind of go along that route. And so my background for Dryden was that he had suffered traumatic brain injury through an IED in Afghanistan, which is the most common injury for soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that it had affected his hearing. So he couldn't be on the front line anymore. But the Q branch had come along and said, well, we can augment your hearing with this neural computer interface, which was just being developed as I was writing the book. And I actually spoke to a couple of military doctors. I called up the army and said to them, I wonder if there's any military doctors who would speak to me. I'm writing James Bond. And there's just this silence at the end of the phone. And then this sergeant said, you're writing James Bond. I said, no, really, I am. It sounds crazy, but you can Google me. And I heard some typing. And then she went, oh, okay, yeah, you are writing James Bond. And she said, someone will call you. And I thought, you know, no one's going to call me. But then this lieutenant colonel called me and we had a two-hour meeting. So I had all of these details that really informed the character. And Dryden's background is so rooted in Afghanistan. Then when I came to writing book two, we withdrew from Afghanistan. Western forces pulled out and left behind the interpreters that had worked so closely with the British Army and are now in really grave danger, and left behind so many, I don't know if left behind is even the right word, but for me, the conditions that women and girls are being forced to live in Afghanistan and that we seem to accept as okay, I found really shocking and disturbing. And I thought, well, I've kind of rooted this character in this conflict and in spending so much time of his life there and building relationships there. So he has to have a response to this. I can't just kind of ignore that it's happened. So book two was then really shaped by that. And there's a section of the book which is about his relationship with his interpreter in Afghanistan and sees him go back there. So the planning was really intricate, but then you have to be prepared to abandon that if something comes along that you think this is really fundamental to the truth of the character and I have to respond to it.
And you've obviously written, this is the second Bond book, there's another one to come, I think, but are you still writing your own stuff in the meantime, or are you focused solely on the Bond stuff at the moment?
I haven't been able to write much of my own stuff in the meantime, simply because the writing schedule and publicity for this has been, as I say, it's a big learning curve. I've never really had experiences like this, that, you know, the book is being published globally, I'm doing events around the world, which has just been amazing. And, you know, I feel so grateful to have those experiences, but it doesn't really leave time for anything else. But I have had, I don't know how you guys do it, but I've had ideas, and I love your page one notebook. I've had ideas that I put in little boxes in my notebook, like they're fenced off in a prison, or, you know, in Monopoly, the go to jail, fenced off like that. Yeah. And when I'm done with these books, I'll open up the gates and see what comes out.
Yeah, brilliant. And so, yes, Spy Like Me is out this week, as we said, as we record this anyway. And the next one, do you have Did you pitch them all at once, or do you? So you have some idea of what that one's about then?
I've just finished writing that one.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. So it was due to the publishers on the 8th of April. This is the sort of craziness of the schedule. Delivering a book and publishing a book in 1 month is a surreal thing. So when people are asking me questions about A Spy Like Me, I keep almost giving away about the third book because it's the one that's...
I can't quite remember, actually. It was so long ago since I wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. So I've just finished it, and I spent the last week writing it at Gladstone's Library, which is the UK's, I want to say, only residential library in the country and the only prime ministerial library. And they do these residencies for writers. So I went there for a week, and it was, I never really experienced a feeling like it. Obviously, I've finished novels before, but it being a trilogy and it being such an intense experience and such a dream, that last night finishing it in the library, I was in the library by myself till about 10 p.m. I didn't stop for dinner because I was in a flow, and sometimes flow feels so precarious. You think if I stop, it'll all go away. And you're not even allowed food in the library. So I smuggled in some tomatoes, which I was in my tote bag illicitly at 10 p.m. And just writing and writing and writing. And then I got to the end, and I thought that I would feel really euphoric. I thought that I would be kind of dancing around the library, but I just felt like I'd sprinted a marathon. I just felt exhausted, and like I was saying goodbye to people who'd been so close to me so intensely for 3 years, these characters. So it's a very strange feeling, and I'm yet to hear. So I sent it around. It's another way that it's very different from other books is that there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So I sent it to the US editorial team, the UK editorial team, and to the Fleming family. And then everybody's thoughts get distilled into a letter. And then you kind of have this sort of cacophony of voices giving ideas. So I'm nervously awaiting that.
Yeah, that must be difficult to deal with, like, do you get conflicting advice, and how do you juggle that then?
You do, yeah.
And I Fleming see you have to follow.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I kind of have a hierarchy of feedback. So yeah. I think, you know, if you're related to the man, I'm going to give your opinion a little bit more weight.
I mean, I have to say, what when you see me, I keep imagining the Fleming family, you know, in my head, they're almost like Bond figures themselves, kind of like in smart suits in drawing rooms, and they call you in for
anything. Or stroking a cat.
Or stroking a white cat, with their bald with one eye.
Being in the mafia. So it's Ian Fleming's nephews and nieces mainly. And they've lived and breathed this their whole lives. So they have this unique relationship to it. But for them, it's normal, which is funny, because to me, you know, being such a massive Bond fan, to me, even to meet them was so exciting.
Yeah.
Mm. And they, for No Time to Die, they have a special premiere that's put on for the family in Leicester Square, which they invite their writers to. So I went to see No Time to Die with the Fleming family and Anthony Horowitz and Charlie Hickson.
Oh, cool.
I mean, it was so surreal. I felt like I floated up outside of my body and was just staring down at myself, you know, thinking, God, if my 12-year-old self could see me now. So we all went to the cinema to see it. And I was saying to the family, like, doesn't this feel kind of surreal to you? You know, the new film and here it is. And they were just looking at me sort of puzzled because it was just their lives. Totally normal for them.
Just the next Bond film.
Just mental to me. As you say, kind of your whole job is just, you know, curating Uncle Ian's Bond books. You know,
exactly.
It's this massive juggernaut thing. It's just,
And it is so personal. And I think that's part of the key to its success in terms of the everlasting nature of James Bond, both for films and books, that for the Broccoli family with the films and the Fleming family for the books, for them, it's deeply personal. It's the only thing they produce. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes you'll see Bond fans saying, I can't believe we have to wait 5 years for the next Bond film. But it's, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of it's how it all works, but, you know, I always think this isn't a company that's kind of cranking out lots of films a year that will make loads of money and, you know, be this kind of turnover. They're focusing on getting this one thing right. And if they don't get that one thing right, it's all lost.
What's the length of time for something to fall into the public domain again? Because I know that's obviously with Sherlock Holmes, that's too old to
75 years.
75.
So does that mean Bond's going to at some point going to come?
Yeah.
Public's domain. Is this 75 years after the death of the?
But it's also different in America and stuff. So like you can have it.
I think it's after the death of the author.
I think it is. Yeah.
Sure.
So at some point they'll lose control. Yeah. And then they have to be out of a job.
But it's like Disney lost control of
Mickey Mouse.
But at the same time, I think after that length of time, it becomes, you know, there'll always be a real version of it.
Yeah,
especially if it's been curated well.
That happened recently, crap, and nobody ever really.
Exactly. Yeah. There's the kind of, you want the, you know, as a fan anyway, I want the seal of approval from.
Yeah, of course.
So to get to be, you know, as a very proud geek myself, to be invited into this world, and as you say, be invited into to play in the sandbox, which I think is a great image for this, and to do something really unprecedented in expanding the world. There'd always been rumors before. I remember when Tomorrow Never Dies came out, people were kind of campaigning for a Wei Lin movie. When Die Another Day came out, saying it would be great if Jinx had a movie, but it had never been this expansion. And I think it's, you know, I feel really grateful to be involved in such an exciting moment where the Flemings have said, let's actually take that step and in some ways follow what the MCU has done, say, or what we're used to in Doctor Who or Star Trek, and say, you know, this can be a really rich world with different protagonists who bring us different adventures. And my approach to that is, you know, I love Bond for Bond. I don't want him to change. But I love being able to bring in these new characters as well and to tell these new stories.
What was the last book that you read?
The last book I read was actually From Russia With Love, which I reread during that week at Gladstone's. So that the week that I was there finishing the book, From Russia With Love is my favourite Bond novel. It's the first one that I read. And the reason that I find it especially inspiring for this project is that it's a really unusual structure where for the first half or so of the novel, we see Bond from the Russian perspective. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing him from the outside and the Russians are trying to bring down Britain and they're kind of concocting this scandal that they're going to embroil MI6 in. You know, this is the time, think about the Cambridge Five, think about all of the sort of spy scandals in the Cold War. And there's this great scene where the Russians are trying to work out who to target. And they say, the strength of Britain lies in myth, the myth of Scotland Yard, Sherlock Holmes, Churchill. Is there no man who represents that myth for the Secret Service? And another character says, there is a man called Bond. And for me, it's really interesting that Fleming is being so self-aware. This is book five. He's created the myth of Britain. The myth of James Bond, and then he spends the whole novel trying to dismantle it. Mm-hmm. And I find that self-awareness really interesting, and I find looking at Bond from the outside, because I've got these other protagonists who give me the opportunity to look at Bond from the outside. So that's a really inspiring novel for me and was my company during my week at Gladstone's. And if anybody hasn't read Fleming, a lot of people have seen the movies but not read the books. I would say read From Russia With Love.
Brilliant.
Nice. What about the last film that you watched?
The last film that I watched? Good question. I haven't watched that many films recently because I've been traveling. I've just got back from Venice and Paris, but where I was doing promotional stuff for the book, which is really fun. But the last TV I watched was, again, while I was at Gladstone's, I watched the old BBC adaptation of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
The
Carla sequence, John le Carré is one of my favorite writers, and Alec Guinness as Smiley I think is just one of the all-time great performances. The subtlety and depth that he brings to that character, it's so defining, you know, to the point that John le Carré actually dedicated the next Smiley novel to Alec Guinness. I think he was kind of taken with what Guinness had done. And I love, so I, when I was younger, I didn't travel all that much. We didn't really have that much money growing up and couldn't go abroad. And so the way that I perceived Europe really was kind of through spy novels and TV series and films and things like that, just gave me this sense of this storied glamour to Europe. And I've always felt that. And that I think that really feeds into my writing now. And that's in part because of John le Carré's books and the adaptations, which just use Cold War era Europe to such amazing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's the main stuff. But the very, very last thing we do is a super quick fire either or. And I always say there's no right answer here apart from perhaps one of them. But we'll start off with, let's go for Bond films or Bond books.
Oh, God. See, immediately you say there's no wrong answers here, but I'm not 50% of people. Bond films or Bond books? Well, because Ian Fleming's been such an influence on my writing, I'm going to say books.
Fair enough.
TV or cinema?
Cinema. But only just. I really had to think about that.
Night owl or early bird?
Night owl, for sure.
Music or no music when you're writing?
Music. I listen to the James Bond
theme
when I'm writing, which is great fun for everyone in the house. That's been going on for 3 years. In a loop.
I'm going to go for another Bond one here. Odd Job or Jaws?
Oh. I'm going to go for Odd Job because I think that sequence in Fort Knox is amazing. One of the best.
Yep.
A fancy restaurant or a takeaway?
Fancy restaurant.
And the last one, a big, hulking, heavy paper book that's just horrible and probably smells a bit, or a really nice electronic ebook which is just light and, you know, and carry a thousand of them. You know, not I don't want to swear you obviously bias here, but just whatever one you think is the correct answer here.
I want the big, heavy, smelly book.
What do I have to say to make people pick an ebook?
I tell you, when ebooks are useful is when I'm traveling for research. So I have all of Fleming's novels on my Kindle. And when I'm going around and I'm going to a place that I want to write about and I'm there and I think, well, how did Fleming write about it? It's, you know, really helpful to be able to call it up. So
that's what happens every time. People pick paper book and then they feel bad and they talk at length of how great ebooks are and these wonderful things. If they're so wonderful, why didn't you pick them? I don't want to hear about it.
Because
books to me are a tactile experience. Yes, exactly. I want that feeling of weight. I want the feeling of the paper. I want to imagine the binder if it's a really old book. I want the smell. Libraries and archives are really my happy place. So anything book lined is where I feel at home.
All right, okay. Fair enough. I'll give you that one then.
So I'm going to make a confession about James Bond.
You've never seen a Bond film?
No, I have. But when I was younger, I always thought, you know, obviously Sean Connery, Roger Moore, mm-hmm. Timothy Dalton, etc. I thought the concept was 007 James Bond was a sort of pseudonym. And
oh, I see. And they were all different.
Take over.
Just take out his code name or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I could totally see that, to be honest. Like, yeah, I mean, it is. There are, well, as Diana the Day showed, there are other 007s. Like, mm-hmm. that is just a number of that someone has. To be fair, I did a rewatch of them all about 6-7 years ago now. I worked through them all. And, apart from realizing there's a lot of really bad Bond films in there,
I've
just forgotten how much some of the older ones really just didn't work for me anymore. But there's also a bit of a arc he has where, because it's a Lazenby one, he gets married mm-hmm. at the end, and then Blofeld mm-hmm. kills his wife, and then Connery comes back with Diamonds Are Forever after that, like age like 55, and he starts off by killing Blofeld at the very start for the death of his wife, and that felt like one of the only, until the Daniel Craig ones, that felt like the only time there was ever any sort of actual continuity. Watch. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because apart from that, they're super standalone. I think I don't remember any other time there's been any kind of carry on.
Yeah, I suppose it's a much more modern phenomenon. You know, even in Kim's books, I suppose, as you know, she sort of mentioned that sort of like the Marvel verse or whatever, expanding a universe. with a continuity is seems to be a more modern
I think that's
approach
right,
to
yeah.
these types
well,
of things.
Well, we've obviously got Star Trek to thank for that, haven't we? It's the first well, shared yeah, universe. Okay, so,
yeah. Marvel
did it quite big, so I suppose. And also interesting how she had to kind of bring the older Bond books into modern time to have characters yeah. coming into it, you know, and rechanging them a little bit.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and also, you know, I think when you take on, you know, as we discussed there, when you take on any sort of franchise mm-hmm. or a big IP, there must be, you know, a moment of hesitation on the part of the author doing it, because even if they write the greatest thing in the world,
yeah.
you're going to get a lot of people that aren't happy with you. And even more so, sadly, if you're not probably a straight white man.
Yeah, that's right. Totally. I think Kim mentioned that, and I think that's exactly right. If you're a woman, especially, or, you know, a minority writer or whatever, writing a beloved franchise, especially a yeah. franchise like Bond, I think, which is quite, you know, it's got a lot of roots in it, misogyny, and a lot of those kind of, especially the older mm-hmm. movies, are quite very much like a kind of, he's a womanizer, mm-hmm. and, you know, the Bond women are often quite lower down on the ladder of equality compared to yes. the more modern Bond films, at least. But yeah, so I think it's a kind of fandom which is probably ripe for just being full of arseholes, really, which is a shame, because
yeah.
there's a lot of...
But as she said, definitely not all of them. I think there's obviously quite a welcoming community there as well, but you're always going to have some of these fans. And, like, you know, you've seen what abuse people that have written or even acted in the Star Wars films and stuff have received, because they don't fit the stereotype that these fans want.
It seems that sometimes the worst viewers are the fans. Like, sometimes it's, mm-hmm. it makes you embarrassed to enjoy something, because I'm like,
exactly.
The whole Jar Jar Binks thing is just awful. I mean,
you
know, the character was awful. I mean, I hate Jar Jar Binks. Don't get me wrong, he ruined Star Wars, but the vitriol that poor guy got is awful.
Yeah, no, it's like, they want things, you know, they want these things made, they want more stories, but then as soon as someone tells a story, it's the wrong one, or something is wrong with it, so it's nonsense. But
and
anyway.
it's the internet, and it's just magnified, and it's worse now, you know, it's easier to
100%.
Be.
I mean, I thought, you know, what Kim was saying there about how she deals with it and stuff is, you know, brilliant and a great example of how you should deal with it. I just think that it must be quite difficult at times if you're in that position to deal with. But thanks very much to Kim for coming on. As we said at the start, A Spy Like Me is just out, so you can go and pick that up right now. I promised last week that we would get to industry episodes. We will next week, because we are going to start with an agent.
A very special agent, in fact.
Yes,
a secret agent.
Yes, James Bond is coming. No. We're going to speak with Francesca Riccardi of Kate Nash Literary Agency, who, conflict of interest alert, she is my agent as well. But no, it's a really interesting chat with Francesca, because she worked in... on the sales side of publishing for a long time before she then moved across to agenting. So we get a bit of the perspective on both sides of the fence there. And it is a video interview as well, so you'll be able to watch that one on YouTube as well if you prefer doing that.
Yeah.
But that will be out next Friday, and it kicks off a whole batch of episodes where we're speaking to agents and editors and people like that, but in the book industry. So you can get you know, we speak to a lot of authors. We see it from that perspective. We're going to see it from the other perspective as well.
Yeah, it's a very, very fun episode next week. A lot of really good stuff. Very sweary, very fun. I liked it a lot.
yes. Content warning about swearing. but otherwise, if you enjoyed this episode, please do take the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app, as that helps us to continue making this podcast.
And of course, if you want to get in touch, you could always drop us an email in the email machine, which is podcast@rightgear.co.uk, or just search for @UKPageOne on any of the major social media sites.
Indeed. But otherwise, have a great week, and we will see you, or you will see us next week.
Nice. See you later.